Pop goes. We might say the meanest things. Pop goes. Sometimes we're not much company. There's no rearranging. Our writing remains the same. We remain the same. And as far as we're concerned, Pop goes. You belong to us. Pop goes.
It's been a long time, been a long time, been a long, lonely, 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 lonely time. Hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 13 of the Pop Does Podcast. I'm Dave Lifton, and contrary to popular belief, we have not gone into the podcasting sunset like so many other shows. Admittedly, some of them have been produced by me. We hope that none of you have deleted your subscriptions, but if you did, you're not hearing this anyway, so screw you. As I mentioned on the last episode, there have been some difficulties in getting all three of us together recently, and that's continued even though the summer is over. So Jeff and I originally decided to go ahead without Jason, and it was just going to be the two of us, but apparently he's nowhere to be found right now. But if he does log on to Skype, I'll be glad to bring him in. And instead, what we were going to do is... We have two other members of the PopDo staff who are going to compensate for the loss of Jason. So let's welcome in Matt Wardlaw and Michael Parr. Gentlemen.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Thanks for the welcome.
Sup, fuckers.
You've been waiting a long time to say that, haven't you, Michael?
A year. A year.
That's right. This is the beginning of our second year. Now, the topic for today, there is a principle known as addition by subtraction. It refers to the removing of the dead weight and letting the real talent shine. This is often used to explain Don Henley's solo career, for example. Why hang around with Timothy B. Schmidt and Glenn Frey and carry their lame asses around when you can hang out with Mike Campbell, you know, and go right with him?
And Stan Lynch.
Yeah, that's right. He was involved in that too, and Stan Lynch is pretty awesome. But today we're going to talk about the opposite concept of that, subtraction by addition. In other words, times where forces in pop culture combined to create something much, much less than the sum of its parts. And let's start with Michael.
All right. Well, you know, in thinking about this, you kind of end up in the abstract, right? You look at something like Batman. Batman's a great character. Playing Batman, not always great. George Clooney is arguably a great actor. George Clooney playing Batman, not so great. and I think that there are others throughout the years. You know, you look at Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez being a huge one, right?
Oh,
Ben Affleck sustainably had, you know, a good career before he met Jennifer Lopez.
Yeah.
He wasn't the best actor. He wasn't great, but he had a career.
And he chose good roles, too.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, he might not be the best actor, but, you know, when you saw him, you knew that he was a smart enough guy to have known his limitations.
Well, I think a good part of that, too, is that, he was mentored pretty early on by Kevin Smith, who put him in some, you know, good roles that made sense for, you know, what his, I guess, abilities were, and, you know, he kind of went from that into doing, you know, similar movies with other folks that made good sense for him. I don't know if we necessarily count Armageddon on that list.
that could fall right into this category, though, couldn't it?
Yeah.
But you add Jennifer Lopez, and it just, you know, it just made that horror show of Geely. I don't know if either of you have actually seen the movie.
No.
I think I might have sat through a few minutes of it when it was on television at some point. But other than that, it's a horror show.
Wait, there was a network that actually paid money to put Geely on the air, thinking that there would be a market for it. And there were advertisers who were willing to... be on at that time, you know, that were paying money to say, hey, we think there's a market for people who are going to watch Geely that we want to advertise our products on.
The USA Network, it'll play anything.
That's true.
All I can figure is that they were speed reading and they thought they were paying money for Grease.
Wait a second. The USA Network actually took time off from SVU marathons and and Burn Notice to show an actual movie.
And reruns of the Office. They do the 5-hour Office marathons.
Right. Yeah, Jesus Christ. I think that the stunt casting in movies is a big problem. I mean, I think of a movie like or the type of gimmick casting, like especially when they do a remake of something, like when they remade Starsky and Hutch. And it's like, okay, it was Ben Stiller and
Owen
Wilson. And it's like, all right, both those guys are funny and they have a kind of similar comedic sensibility. And then it's like, all right, who's going to play Huggy Bear? And it's like, of course, Snoop Dogg. And it's like, yeah, of course I want to watch that just because it's so ridiculous and it's awful. You know, and I think that more than anything else really killed Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson. I think that's why Owen Wilson tried to kill himself. It was because he needed to get out of shitty movies like that. He had just done way too many of them.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that, you know, so often, like, so many of those remakes are such a bad idea to begin with, and you can see that so many times just in the casting before you even see the movie.
Yeah, and the Dukes of Hazzard movie?
Yeah, exactly.
Also is the same thing with Willie Nelson as Uncle Jesse and Jessica Simpson as Daisy. You know, you just know it's not going to work.
I don't know. See, as a Willie fan, it's like, I mean, that would be the one part that would kind of make me want to see the movie if you could subtract pretty much 80% of the rest of the cast.
Right.
Like when I saw Willie Nelson in Wag the Dog, I mean, I thought that like his part, you know, pretty much was one of the great parts of that whole movie, which overall I thought was a great movie anyway. But I mean, he's definitely a guy that they've put him in some movies, you know, with great parts, you know, that really kind of were a good accessory to the movie and not just a pointless cameo.
Well, I think we could probably even go with, you know, seriously, Hollywood and remakes alone as a category. You know, I've yet to see one that, you know, I truthfully enjoyed as much as the original. I've not seen the A-Team movie yet, though, but I hear that that was the one that was actually good.
Well, the Ocean's 11 franchise.
Yeah.
The first and the third movies were good because those didn't try to recreate really the plot as much as get a modern vibe to it. You know, they said, okay, we can't recreate the Rat Pack. There's no point in doing that. But let's just, you know, get kind of our own little thing going here and make something that's really stylish and just kind of draws upon that vibe but doesn't, you know, look really to recreate it.
Yeah, and I think that with a, you know, with something like that, with that franchise, you know, what was great about that was that, you know, for the folks that, you know, knew the original series, I think that those movies, you know, held up. But I think also, you know, for the folks that had no idea about the original series, those movies were just as relevant and just as good. Like, I mean, they did a really good job of, you know, really making movies that, you know, fit with today's time. They almost kind of approached it from the angle of, like, you know, they were just making new movies rather than doing a reboot.
Right. I think the first one, the real joy of the original one was just seeing those guys together and just kind of playing off each other. The story is nothing great. But here they did a lot more work with, you know, plot and characterization, that it was a little bit more, it was just more fun. I mean, the Andy Garcia character was fantastic. And even in the third one, Al Pacino basically doing an impression of Steve Wynn was a stroke of genius, because I'm a big Vegas fan, and if you've ever heard an interview with Steve Wynn, he can be kind of blustery and egomaniacal. He's a brilliant man, but sometimes he's just a little insane.
Just on the George Clooney tip, would you say that George Clooney probably could have made some better movie choices over the years? I think that statistically he's been a part of some pretty bad projects.
You know, I don't think there's an actor, any good actor about whom you can't say that.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, even you think about, you know, some of the choices that, you know, even De Niro, Pacino, those guys, I mean, they've made some bad movies.
Did you guys like Righteous Kill?
I'm not familiar with that at all.
I'm laughing because that was actually going to be on my list of you know, taking two greats, putting them together, and making it awful. But you know, you couldn't call it awful. That was the problem.
You know, I enjoyed that for what it was. I mean, I guess I wasn't looking as much into it as a lot of people looked into that, you know, just hated that movie. But that's just one of those that I know a lot of people hated that movie. But really, I mean, you know, it's like I kind of enjoyed that one.
Well, it's hard not to hate it. When you think about it, you know, the whole premise behind Heat, right, the original movie where it was the two of them and you know, we would finally get that moment where Pacino and De Niro were actually sharing screen time. And it was so great. And then you realized it was, you know, a 15-minute or 10-minute conversation in a restaurant. You're like, you kind of feel chipped. You know, you waited all these years to see these two actors in the same scene together, and that's all you get. So I think, you know, Righteous Kill was supposed to be the remedy to that, and it just fell short.
Well, what I remember, A Fish Called Wanda, and what, you know, that was, you know, John Cleese and Palin, and as a huge Python fan, it's like, all right, John Cleese and Michael Palin, and it was the exact opposite of that, where they also didn't have a scene together until the very end. You know, when John Cleese runs into the flat and says, "Are you him?" I forgot Michael Palin's character's name, and it's like, oh yeah, you know, these two guys haven't been in the thing, and then they have that scene where he's taking the French fries out of his nose. And you know, and that's a hysterical scene in the great in the Python tradition where he's trying to get the stutter out of him, you know. But as opposed to the scene in Heat where it is just, all right, kind of bland, where all the tension is coming because of what you're expecting to happen.
What would you guys say? I think that and this might just be because I'm a fan, but you know, I think John Cusack has been pretty consistent through his career.
Must Love Dogs and America's Sweetheart, I think, would be the opposite. I think when he goes for like a mainstream romantic comedy, he's pretty crappy in that.
Yeah.
Well, and I think America's Sweetheart's probably a good. Yeah, that was one that I thought of, but then kind of hedged on. Was, you know, you had what, Billy Crystal, Julia Roberts. And I can't think of her name, Catherine Zeta-Jones and John Cusack. On paper, it should be amazing. In reality, yeah. not so much.
Yeah.
I guess that would be kind of like, you know, the more recent example of that type of movie was, I guess, that recent movie, that Valentine's Day movie that had pretty much everybody in it.
You didn't love that movie, Matt?
Surprisingly, I haven't seen it yet. Should I see it?
I kind of figured you had.
Oh, I kind of figured you owned it, so I could just borrow it from you.
Yeah.
No, he doesn't own it. He did have to borrow the special director's cut from Jason, though. You are listening to Hot Toes. All right, Matt, what do you have?
No, you know what? I mean, I think that my example that I would throw out, I have a couple that I would throw out of like combinations that seemed good on paper, but certainly seemed to cause a lot of controversy. The first one that I'm going to throw out two real quick here, but the first one that I would throw out is the Doobie Brothers with Michael McDonald, and then the New Cars with Todd Rundgren. Now, with the second project, I think that pretty much everybody universally hated the presence of Rundgren in the New Cars, unless you were a Rundgren fan. But I think that the Doobie Brothers side of things is kind of more interesting just because, you know, you either really liked what Michael McDonald brought to that band, or in the case of what I would say is the majority, you know, you talk to a lot of music fans and they'll tell you how Michael McDonald ruined the Doobie Brothers and that band was never the same, you know, after he joined that band.
It's blasphemy.
It's a good thing Jason's not here to.
I'm with you. I'm a huge Michael McDonald fan, and for me, I mean, I liked the Doobie Brothers with Michael McDonald, so I have no issues there. But it's just funny because every time I try to talk about that band with anybody, that's what inevitably 98% of them will bring up, is that, you know, man, I really love that band, but I really, you know, hate that band because of what happened after Michael McDonald joined the band. So it's really interesting. And then the other interesting piece of that is all these years later, how many people still think that Michael McDonald is with the Doobie Brothers?
I blame Steely Dan for all that.
Yeah.
Because what happened was that Skunk Baxter and Michael McDonald were touring with Steely Dan, and the Doobie Brothers, it was, I don't remember who was headlining or if it was a co-billing, but they were on tour together, and oh no, actually Steely Dan were opening for the Doobie Brothers, and you know, those guys just, you know, Skunk just wanted to keep on playing. He just loved to play live, and he had a great bunch of musicians in the Doobie, so he would just like sit in with the Doobie Brothers their set, and so they're like, hey, join us. And then this was right around the time that Steely Dan were kind of getting tired of the road, where Becker and Fagen were just like, well, we just kind of want to work in the studio all day. And, you know, and Michael was you know, part of the touring Steely Dan, so he wound up joining the Doobie Brothers. So then that's kind of like what enabled that change. And so anybody who wants to blame Michael McDonald should really be blaming Donald Fagen and Walter Becker. And if they do that, I'll just accuse them of anti-Semitism.
And there you go.
I don't know. It's interesting listening to the new Doobie Brothers CD, because Michael McDonald is on a cut on that CD, and you know, doing kind of almost background vocals more than anything. But that song, it's interesting because it sounds more like a Steely Dan song than a Michael McDonald. I'm sorry, than a Doobie Brothers song. But there's some pretty, you know, mellow stuff on that album that Michael McDonald had nothing to do with. You know, which kind of just points to, you know, if you really get PO'd about, you know, the Doobie Brothers heading in a mellow direction, perhaps you should point the finger, you know, somewhere else besides Michael McDonald.
But yeah, I am glad you say that, because that's actually my pick as well. It's the idea to any band that has two versions of it out there, because its members can't get along. You know, yesterday we were all emailing about Styx re-recording its hits without Dennis DeYoung. Now, I don't want to see the Tommy Shaw fronted Styx.
No.
You know, and I can't really hate Jeff, because he did coin the great phrase, I'd like to see Tommy Shaw eaten by seals. and I don't want to see Dennis solo. But if those guys got back together, you know, it wouldn't be, I wouldn't mind seeing that, but only if, you know, if it was like at a Taste of Chicago or some other free summer festival. And I think that nobody is more indicative of this than the Beach Boys. Oh. And as always on the Pop Dos podcast, whenever the topic of the Beach Boys comes up, we have to say it all together now. Fuck
Mike.
Fuck Mike Love.
And I mean, you've got these three Beach Boys related acts, you know, on the road. None of them are worth a damn. You've got, you know, Mike and Bruce Johnston working as the Beach Boys. You know, Brian, you can't, he can't sing anymore, but it doesn't really matter. He just gets a standing ovation, you know, just for being able to make it through a show without a complete meltdown. And then you've got, you know, Al Jardine's Endless Summer, which, you know, who gives a shit? The least essential member of the Beach Boys has a touring band? What the? But I did find this out. You know who's playing for saxophone for Al Jardine's band?
Who's that?
Richie Cannata.
Oh, wow.
Billy Joel's original sax player. And I was looking that up, and I saw that last night, and I just thought, all right, Rico!
You know, I did see that. What's the story? Where did he and Billy fall out?
I couldn't see. I never knew that, because I remember, like, when I saw the I didn't even know about that until the Live in Long Island video came out when it was on HBO. And, you know, there was this other guy, it was Mark Rivera, and was like, well, what happened to Richie Cannata? And I was looking that up. It's like, what happened? And it didn't seem like that there was a falling out, because he's still done some work with him in the, over the years. I think he I'm guessing he just probably at the time got tired of the road. He like in 1981, he opened up his own studio on Long Island, So I think maybe he just kind of wanted to get into production and session work, and that was that. That seems to have been very good for him. If you look at his website, he's got a pretty strong list of production and session credits. So, you know, good for him.
So, I mean, getting back to things, I mean, that Beach Boys thing that you bring up, that's a great example because, you know, I think the difference for me is that minus Carl Wilson, who, I mean, I just think is just awesome, you know, the Beach Boys are at this point a band that I really do not want to see Al and Brian get back together with Mike and Bruce. It's just like, that's just one of those reunions that's like, you know, really overall, you know, no disrespect to Brian, but it's just like, I want to see, you know, most of all those guys just basically just hang it up. I want to see, you know, Mike Love and Bruce Johnston put the Beach Boys thing on the shelf. Just stop. You know, Al Jardine, I mean, I heard that new solo record that he put it out, and, you know, it's like I wanted for that to be good, but, man, it's just not good. And then Brian's the only one this year that kind of, like, actually surprisingly – with that Gershwin disc, I mean, that Gershwin disc is actually really good. And
I didn't like it at all.
Really?
I didn't care for it either.
You know, it just like took a bunch of Gershwin songs, these great songs, and gave it a Pet Sounds arrangement treatment. And I don't think that captures the harmonic depth of those songs. It's like, hey, let's just put a bass clarinet on a Fascinating Rhythm's not on there. It was the first one I could think of on a Someone to Watch Over Me. And Brian just can't sing with any emotion anymore. He's just singing the melody. I just don't think there's an awareness of what the lyric means, even though he genuinely truly loves the music. But it just sounded sad to me.
I don't know, man. I mean, I haven't wanted to hear a Brian Wilson record in the longest time just because of where he is. And, I mean, I thought that vocally, you know, granted there might have been, you know, tons of studio trickery going on to make it happen. But, I just thought that, you know, vocally, he sounded better than I ever would expect to ever hear him sound again.
I thought he sounded better on the Smile album.
Oh, really?
He sounded maybe a little more engaged in that.
Yeah.
I just didn't think that he sounded. I think he wanted to be excited about this because I think he genuinely has a love of those songs. There was just something that wasn't putting it through.
But don't you get the kind of the idea that you know, somewhere there's an A&R guy that was, you know, sat down with Brian and said, Brian, I got a great idea. It works for Rod Stewart. It works for Manilow. They all have number one records. You know, they do the American Songbook. You're going to do Gershwin.
See, I got that idea, and that's exactly why I didn't want to hear that. But at the same time, when I heard the record, I was like as cynical and pissed off as I had been about the fact that record was going to exist. Once I heard it, I was actually like kind of like, okay. And as somebody that typically hates anything that is in the same vein as, you know, the Rod Stewart stuff that you mentioned, you know, I was like, all right, I actually kind of can get behind this. I think that there's a project that's coming behind this one that I definitely don't want to hear, which is Brian Wilson sings Disney songs, you know, so to hear about those two back to back, you know, Gershwin and then a project of Disney songs, it was like, all right, you know, you're officially out of ideas, you know, just stop, you know, so... The Gershwin CD was at least a nice surprise for me.
The Disney songs, though, I know exactly how they're going to market that. Because Surfer Girl, Brian Wilson took the melody for When You Wish Upon a Star. When you wish upon a star, you know, little surfer, little...
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty well... You didn't know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Okay. No, he famously he has said that he had done that.
It was
very much an inspiration, and so you know that's going to be on there.
Yeah,
and that will be the marketing angle behind it. But I just can't. I just don't want to hear it because hearing Brian try to sing these days just makes me sad.
No, exactly. I mean, honestly, you know, you tell me that he sounded more engaged on the Smile record, and I'll be honest and say that I really didn't even bother to check that out, and I really haven't bothered to check like the last four or five things out that he's done, just because, you know, that's exactly it. It's, you know, hearing him sing these days just makes me sad. It's not that I want him to, like, you know, continue to make Beach Boys records forever, but at the same time, it's just like, that really is just one of those things that I would rather just remember things like they were and not hear where he's at today.
What about Superstar? You know, we were talking about this in just before about the movies where they get like six or eight big name characters. What about when they've done that in music?
I think a good one for that, Dave, is Velvet Revolver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
and
let me tell you about Velvet Revolver. Oh, God. Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
You know, and doesn't it kind of, you know, the whole thought was, you know, Guns N' Roses is gone. It's over. I don't care what you say about what they're touring with now or what whoever they're playing with. It's over. It's been over for, you know, longer than they were together.
If it's not Axl and Slash, it's not Guns N' Roses.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, to try and do that with Weiland, I mean, you know, I give him credit for trying. And truthfully, I would much rather hear Velvet Revolver than, you know, anything off of the Chinese Democracy. But but it's still, you know, it was just wrong.
But the worst thing about Velvet Revolver is that it paved the way for Audioslave.
that would be next on my list. I can't stand that band.
Where did those two fall chronologically, though? Didn't Audioslave come before Velvet Revolver? I wanted to think that Audioslave was like 2001 or so, and Velvet Revolver, I think, was like 2003, 2004, or something like that.
By a year.
So really, we should hate Audioslave more because Audioslave paved the way for Velvet Revolver.
Well, I just hate Chris Cornell, so anything that he's in is fair game for me.
And him working with Timbaland. That was largely panned as like the worst album of the year.
I got to tell you, when you know they have that this 15 albums thing going around on Facebook right now. yeah. I had a friend who I had asked to do it, and then, you know, her friend started responding underneath, you know, within the post, and I swear to God that someone actually put that record on their 15 records, and. And I looked at my friend and I said, you maybe shouldn't be friends with that person.
Well, the meme, as I recall, is 15 albums that will stay with you. I think that if you've actually heard that album, that's embedded in your soul forever and you can't get it out. So maybe that's the point.
So using that thought process, they're correct to put that album on their list.
Right, exactly. Now, Michael, you said you had a really great example of a supergroup one-off project that really didn't work out.
and this one, everyone will remember. I believe it was the movie was The Three Musketeers, which was awful in its own right. And to top off the awfulness, it had the theme song sung by Sting, Bryan Adams, and Rod Stewart. The absolutely horrible All for Love.
Yeah, it's Jesus Christ. I want to point that to the as the beginning of the end for Sting, but like right after that, he put out 10 Summoner's Tales, which I think was the last great record that he did. And ever since, you know, and ever since then, he's been Sting.
Well, and you think about it, you know, it's a, you know, you look at the song, it's a Mutt Lang song, right? So, you know, obviously on paper, it's Mutt Lang with Michael Kamen, you know, doing the orchestral bits. You know, it's the prime example of every excess that you can put into a single song. You know, short of having, you know, Eric Clapton play the guitar solo. You know?
This was a song that didn't even have the decency to be written by Jim Vallance.
Well, since we mentioned Eric Clapton, let's give a special additional soundtrack subtraction points for his thing with Elton John. What was that, Runaway Train?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I kept waiting for that train to, you know, hit something.
Clapton and Babyface, too.
I was gonna say Clapton and Babyface. It's funny. I was I'm listening to and reviewing the new Clapton record, so I was kind of digging back and looking at some of his older material, and you know, you come across that song, and you're like, oh God! And to most people, you know, that's the last good thing he did, and you're like, oh gosh, it's so bad. All right, so I have one more music one, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to catch a ton of crap for this.
Probably.
Michael Jackson, wonderful. Paul McCartney, wonderful. The Girl Is Mine, not wonderful. Say, Say, Say is excellent. No.
Say, Say, Say is crap.
Yeah.
No. Say, Say, Say is great. Flip it around, Girl Is Mine, not so great.
See, now I can't think of Say, Say, Say without a great line by Lewis Black. it was after the Tony Awards, and Lewis Black was on the Daily Show talking about it, and they had an awful piece of stunt casting on the Tonys, where Carol Channing and LL Cool J presented an award together.
I remember this.
Yeah, and... you know, Carol Channing was like 85 years old and, you know, still dressing like Dolly, you know, Dolly Levi. And Lewis Black said that he hadn't seen a better example for segregation since the video for Say, Say, Say.
I'm laughing at that, but of course that's not funny at all. So...
yeah.
Just for the record.
But yeah, Say, Say, Say. But I was also thinking about also about Michael Jackson. You know, his work, the records he did with Quincy Jones, you know, absolutely amazing and groundbreaking and incredible. And then once he started piling on more producers, you know, that just really, I think showed that Michael had lost the plot musically, that, you know, he needed Quincy there.
Well, I think you could say the same.
Yeah, I would say that. Yeah.
You say the same of Prince as well. Right. You know, all of his records through his Warner Brothers contract up until the end there, you know, were by and large brilliant. And then, you know, once he was given free reign, you know, he just started releasing crap.
Well, that's subtraction by subtraction.
Yeah, that's
remove
that's
all
true.
The people who will say, no, Prince, that's not a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah, he lost someone that would actually say, you know, sorry, you shouldn't include a 12-minute song about your wife because no one really cares.
Right. Unless you're talking about how awesome she's in bed and you're not going to do that anymore because you're a Jehovah's Witness and you're taking all the profanity out of your music, all the stuff that made you great.
Actually, you know what? We could say it's subtraction by addition because it was once he met Larry Graham.
Hmm.
He met Larry Graham and started working with Larry Graham, and Larry Graham dragged him into being a Jehovah's Witness, and that was it. It was over.
Good point.
Though, you know, to be honest and to be fair, you know, when he does make an effort, I'll say, you know, musicology or you know, even his most recent record was decent. And, you know, I'm a fanboy when it comes to Prince, so I like it all.
No.
So, but objectively, I know a lot of it sucks. I don't care that it sucks. I still like it. but you know, from that standpoint, I would say, you know, without an editing ear, he is given free rein to just release garbage.
Yeah, and but Prince plus the Minnesota Vikings.
Oh God,
stay away.
Oh God, I pretend that didn't exist. I mean, I'm a diehard, and that record, that song, oh God.
Yeah, what you said about Prince, I would say the same thing, that, you know, McCartney's been given free rein to release a lot of garbage.
Here's another reason why Say 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 deserves to be sent to the ash heap of history. Right, when I was doing the Michael Jackson book, I came across this, and not coming across like I do Jason's mom.
But damn it, I have to see her tonight. Stop.
I don't know how many of you know this, but the B-side to Say 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 was called Ode to a Koala Bear.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Just horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah. So that's why I, you know, as bad as Say 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 was, or even as mildly pleasant as it might have been, the very fact that a song called Ode to a Koala Bear exists is reason enough to say that, you know, this never should have happened.
Well, while on the topic of McCartney, how about Ebony and Ivory?
Yeah, that too. And I don't even want to know the B-side to Ebony and Ivory. Subpuckers! And now it's time for the endorsement section of the Pop Dose podcast, where everyone recommends something that they have been digging on lately. And let's start with Matt.
You know what? My endorsement, I'm going to recommend the new record, No Chocolate Cake, the new record by the Gin Blossoms. So I'm gonna flesh this out, but you know, I mean, I think it's the Gin Blossoms obviously are a band that have caught a lot of shit during their existence, because they made, in the eyes of many people, you know, one great album with the New Miserable Experience record. You know, then you come to find out that allegedly it is their you know, alcoholic guitarist Doug Hopkins, who you know, sadly was, you know, booted out of the band and later died, that was, in the eyes of many people, responsible for the bulk of the Gin Blossoms songwriting on that New Miserable Experience record. And that much is true if you look at the credits, and certainly if you heard the record, congratulations, I'm sorry, that they made after the New Miserable Experience. Certainly that is such a perfectly titled record, because congratulations, I'm sorry, it's almost like the title was the instant apology for you, the listener, the sucker that had bought that record, and, you know, you were listening to it, because that, I don't know if you guys want to, you know, give me any other suggestions, but that might be one of the worst follow-ups to a big record of all time. Like, it's awful.
But yet, it did spawn a couple of hits.
Well, Till I Hear It From You was co-written by Marshall Crenshaw, and that was, and it was on the Empire Records soundtrack.
I was going to say, not on that record. So I would say that the hits, I think Follow You Down was a hit, but it was marginal. But yeah, I mean, I think that Till I Hear It From You was their last real hit, and that was co-written with Marshall Crenshaw. So,
right.
Now, I'll say I saw the Gin Blossoms it was a month and a half ago.
Yeah.
At Mohegan Sun, where you know, where we make our yearly pilgrimage to go and scream at Jack Wagner.
Yeah.
And I mean, I have to say, as a band, they were very tight. But it's very clear that even the new songs, and they played three new songs that night. The new songs are just so derivative.
Yeah.
That it makes it difficult. And I, you know, it's like watching that faded glory and hanging on to it as long as you can. I will give them that they, you know, they still sound decent. You know, Robin's voice is still strong, which, you know, is surprising. And Dave, I know you don't like off-key singers, but, you know, he was able to hit every note in all those songs.
Yeah.
Not that they're, you know.
He has like a 5-note range to begin with, but he stays within his range, and it's, and as long as he can do it live, you know, that's cool. I got no problem with that. Yeah.
And that's the thing, he didn't reach. So you know, it sounded great.
So and my point in, you know, offering that up is the endorsement is that after, you know, congratulations, I'm sorry, kind of proved a lot of people right that, you know, the Gin Blossoms could not write songs. I don't think that anybody ever expected the Gin Blossoms to release another album that you could put in the good category or a great category, wherever you want to put it. And when they, you know, made their first reunion record a few years back, the Major Lodge Victory record, that was a really good record, and, you know, really would have fit nicely as a follow-up to New Miserable Experience. And I think that you can put this new record, No Chocolate Cake, in that same category. So now, you know, to all the folks that, you know, say that the Gin Blossoms can't write songs, they've now made, you know, two records that suggest otherwise.
Yeah, 15 years after anybody wants to hear them again.
Well, and that's...
they learned 15 years later.
That's kind of the thing is, unfortunately, now they're kind of making records... at a time when there's no longer, like, say, a radio audience where they fit in. And I thought it was really interesting. First of all, it's worth pointing out that guitarist Jesse Valenzuela wrote a lot of the material on this new record and co-wrote a lot of it with Danny Wilde from the Rembrandts. So take that for what it's worth.
Yeah.
But I read an interview with Robin and with Jesse, separate interviews, on the Huffington Post recently, and I found it really interesting that Robin Wilson was, you know, looking at the success of a band like Train specifically, that he puts the Gin Blossoms kind of on the same career path as Train and sees the current, you know, huge amount of success that Train is having, and was questioning, you know, what would it take to get Gin Blossoms here, you know, with a new record of songs that have the same potential in his mind as the songs that Train is putting out there. What's it going to take to get Gin Blossoms back to the top of the heap? And
hopefully it's fewer Mr. references.
I was going to go with he just has to, you know, sell his soul to the devil like Pat Monahan. Oh, and rip off Jason Mraz once in a while.
So I don't know. You know, it's just... It's interesting because, you know, I think that there are bands like the Gin Blossoms that are making great records, but, you know, realistically, especially when you're on a label like 429 Records, I mean, it's just like the reality in the world out there is that, you know, unless you're on a Sony or whatever that, you know, is putting the promotional dollars behind you to, you know, get you out where you need to be at radio, you know, Gin Blossoms can write really great songs, but that doesn't mean that anybody's going to hear them in today's radio climate.
Right. You're only going to hear them at rib fests.
Yeah. Well, and here, that was the other interesting piece of the Huffington Post interview was that Robin Wilson, and imagine how much this would suck. I would kind of put this in the same category as people asking if Michael McDonald's still in the Doobie Brothers. Well, the question that Robin Wilson said that he is most annoyed about that he constantly gets asked is the question, are the Gin Blossom are the Gin Blossoms still together? I mean, how much does that, you know, for when, I mean, those guys are out touring a lot, so how much does that suck for you as a band when as the, you know, main guy in the band, it's like when you're talking to people, that's what people are constantly asking you. It's like, hey, man, you still doing shows? You still doing anything with that Gin Blossoms band?
I'll be honest with you. After seeing the Gin Blossoms, I was waiting because while I was seeing the Gin Blossoms, my wife was in seeing Michael Bublé,
right?
Which I refused to go to. So the Gin Blossoms happened to be playing for free out in the Wolf's Den. And after the fact, I had gone up and, you know, was kind of hanging out in the casino, and I did see Robin, and he's a very nice guy. You know, he definitely took a minute to talk to anyone that stopped by and said hello, and you know, was very gracious considering, And crap, where was I going with this?
Well, he was especially very gracious considering that he had Jason's mom waiting for him backstage.
I think if I had Jason's mom waiting for me backstage, I would, you know, basically do whatever I could to stay outside.
I'm going to say that must be why he was tanking up. but my point was going to be was, you know, truthfully, it was maybe less than 15 minutes after he had walked off stage that he was sitting at a bar, not, you know, not 20, 30, 40 feet away. And really no one cared.
Somebody please notice me. Somebody please, hey, Tomorrow We Can Drive Around This Town song? That was me, God damn it.
I just sang it, damn it.
You should like be walking around with a t-shirt and say, I'm the guy from the Gin Blossoms, just so people know who the hell he is.
You know, my favorite story of just like seeing a show that was like a great show, just because, well, you know, 2002 when they got back together, they went on a tour with the Spin Doctors who had reunited with their original lineup, and I saw them play a show where it was four bands. It was them, it was the Spin Doctors, Seven Mary Three, and Sponge for $10.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
And all the bands, you know, did meet and greets and signed autographs after the set. So can you really beat that for $10? I mean, you know, even for you, cynical Dave Lifton, aren't the Gin Blossoms worth $250 to you?
Yeah, but to have to sit through Sponge and Seven Mary Three... You know, Seven Mary Three are the band that I look at as the moment when grunge died.
Yeah.
When it... All right, Candlebox, you could kind of say that, but that was kind of like, you know, my first grunge band. but Seven Mary Three, I was working at a chain record store at the time, and I was manager, and the year that they... 95, we had our pre-Christmas managerial conference for the whole region, and, you know, where the labels were bringing around different bands, and they brought Seven Mary Three, and I'm just like, Jesus Christ, I got to get the hell out of here.
Well, when you meet a band where there's a member in the band named Gitti, G-I-T-I, it's like, Gitti? That's your name?
Yeah.
What does that mean? Where does that come from?
But God, if you've become cumbersome to this world, then just don't tell us about it. Just end it.
Just take yourself to the water's edge and jump in.
Right. Don't bring us down with you.
Yeah. Oh, Matt. For those that don't know, because, well, that's probably most of you, Water's Edge was the awful follow-up to Cumbersome.
Oh, God.
Oh, man.
That was bad.
Thanks, Michael. I didn't really think that we'd have to fill in the blank on that one, but I guess that was more obscure than I realized.
Because everyone had that record.
I didn't.
No, I think I was at the time I was a DJ and I DJed an alternative night and I had it, but it was on like the X Games soundtrack or something, your jock rock or something. I couldn't bring myself to actually purchase the record for the one song.
You're such a mystery, it's never clear to me. You're always leaving me second guessing, and all I wanna know is, baby, where you go, where you've been, when you come up missing.
And Michael, what is your endorsement?
For my endorsement, I'm going to go with, and I'm not really sure how to do this. Basically, Kanye West every Friday is releasing a new track, and he's committed to do this through December. And you know, love him or hate him, he certainly is putting out some decent music these days. And he's, I think he's 6 or 7 tracks in now. And actually, not this week that we're talking, but the previous week was a track called Lord, 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 which was just monstrous, you know, very soulful, very reminiscent of, you know, the stuff off of his second record, you know, and really, I think, you know, after being such a jackass and you know, going away for a little while, I think the time away certainly did him good, and he's going to come back and surprise a lot of people, I think.
Do you think that with Kanye, the since everybody finds him so despicable as a human being, that he'll be able to regain his stature? I mean, it seems to me that his contrition via Twitter to Taylor Swift, and you know, the song that he did at the awards was less genuine than an example of more of his typical self-aggrandizement.
Well, and I think it is that ego. And I think it's the ego that keeps him going. And I think, truthfully, it's the ego that everyone was interested in the first place. I mean, if you think about, you know, his first track was about him, Through the Wire. You know, everything he's done, Jesus Walks, all these tunes are very ego-driven. I think that, you know, he suffers from lead singer disease, but like on, you know, a scale that, you know, we don't know about yet. You know, it's like David Lee Roth times a million.
You said that like Ronnie Wood. And I've never heard any interviews with Ronnie Wood, but he has obvious, for very obvious reasons, he's had some problems with egotistical lead vocalists.
I couldn't imagine. You know?
All right, so to get back to Kanye, what were you before we interrupted you?
Lead vocalists. You know, I think that he exists in a plane that, you know, it's so far beyond ego at this point that, you know, he really does, I think, truthfully believe that, you know, he's the shit, and and you know that everyone will fit to him, because think about it, you know, even his last record, the 808 and Heartbreaks, just an absolute, you know, left turn from where his career was going. And, you know, granted, he started and finished some awful trends with the singing in auto-tune, despite the fact that he could barely sing. And, you know, he did it, and it just didn't matter what anyone thought, because he did it for himself. And I think, you know, that again comes from a very egocentric place. So it's interesting, and I think he's fascinating. I also think that the entire Taylor Swift thing was MTV. That was all them.
Of course, that wasn't. It has to be, because a guy all of a sudden comes on stage, and you know, at that distance, and nobody in security.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. They encouraged that, if not, you know, made it happen.
Right. That's pretty obvious whenever you see something like that. But it still had really backfired on him, something fierce.
It did. And that's why I think I don't know that he has anything to prove, but I think the fact that he's out making music and saying, here it is, it's free every week, just handing it out, you know. I would say more than just, you know, he's just kind of handing it out and saying, I don't care what you think, this is what I'm doing, and enjoy it if you want, and if you don't, screw you.
It's certainly a nothing else left to lose approach. So, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's a good way to try to get yourself back out there after you've really torpedoed yourself to such a high level.
The carnival till bell, the hustle for the age, the clutch what they covet, what must they give away? Who was uninvited, who was asked to come and stay? Surprise, it's your life, it's your business anyway, so please spot these in such curious minds. Peace, safe passage, precious time, hither and gone. The day of days, Yom Kiyom. This tiny stone illuminated by a star fall. Not only stars so large, many more. To make our largest stars show small. Furthermore, the end is not the end, no stop but a pause. And what we can witness isn't all that is it all. Custom mock over scotch and pork chops. The passion, expansion, the order of the random. See the dreamers, see the sleepers. Wide Eureka, sweet Jesus, and life on earth. Seek heaven first, put in this work.
This is something special.
Okay, as for my endorsement, I have two, actually. The first is that Bored to Death is back for its second season on HBO. We're recording this today before the season premiere, but the clips I've seen so far have been great. If you missed the first season, it stars Jason Schwartzman as a writer who's having trouble with his second novel. And after a drunken Raymond Chandler binge, he decides to become an unlicensed private detective in New York City. And it's all about his adventures. And, you know, 10 years later, it's still impossible to see Jason Schwartzman as anything other than Max Fisher from Rushmore.
Nice.
Because I think there's a part of him that's always going to be Max Fisher in every role that he gets. And there is kind of like a little bit of that, but he's a little bit of a more genial character, but kind of like the I'm smarter than everybody else thing is still there. But he's still really funny in this, and it also stars Ted Danson and Zach Galifianakis as his friends who kind of wind up on these adventures with him as his co-stars. It's just a very, very funny show. Did either of you guys catch the first season of that?
No, but I have a funny Jason Schwartzman. My sister is engaged to a young man who resembles him so closely that I have a hard time not associating him with Jason Schwartzman's Rushmore character. It's actually funny.
Just, well, you know, if you ever see like my bar mitzvah pictures, I wasn't that much different from him either. There's like, you know, thick glasses and small and skinny, and it's just, you know, it might as well be him. It was pretty that I think that's one reason why I love Rushmore so much.
Nice. Yeah, I haven't seen the show either, but you know, based on, you know, what you've said about the show and some other folks recently, I mean, it's definitely been on my list that I want to you know, hopefully Netflix like the first season and get caught up.
Yeah, it is on DVD and should also be on on demand as well.
Cool.
Hi.
Hi.
Can I ask you a few questions?
Who are you?
My name is Jonathan Ames. I'm a private detective.
You don't look like a cop.
I'm a private cop.
You a security guard? Why aren't you wearing your outfit?
Private detectives don't wear outfits, okay? Look, you recognize this man?
Yeah, I know him. He comes in with a cooler every couple days and doesn't order anything.
I'm an illustrator. I'm a little low on money right now.
You ever seen him with two women?
Yeah, they were nice. They spent money. They also had a cooler. It was weird. Why were you always carrying that thing?
I don't mean to be rude, but I was transporting chilled semen.
Shut up.
You shut up.
Look, the two women you saw him with are missing. Do you know where they live?
I don't know where any of these people live. Let me ask you something. If you don't know where they live, how do you know they're missing?
That's an excellent point, Scott.
And my second endorsement is the new Superchunk album, Majesty Shredding. It's their first album in 9 years. In the 90s, they kind of passed me by. I don't recall hearing them on the radio. And the store that I worked in, because it was a big chain whose name will not be mentioned, we didn't carry a lot of indie labels. So I'd kind of like lumped them in with the lo-fi, slacker, ironic bands like Pavement and Yolo Tango that I've never had any use for, which is Guided by Voices and Built to Spill. They all kind of like all sounded the same to me. And I just had, you know, I didn't hear the buzz in there because I didn't hear effort.
I certainly didn't hear that with the Guided by Voices thing. So that's an excellent point.
Yeah. You know, it's like they have like, you know, good ideas, but as soon as they start to develop them, then they just would like blow up the song in a morass of feedback. And it's like, why the hell are you doing this? give me a fucking chorus. But with Superchunk, I heard the first single, Digging for Something, and I was kind of shocked to hear that there were really a melodic punk band with a bright, sunny sound and a lot of fun. So I checked out the rest of Majesty Shredding, and it's great, and I'm going to go back and discover their earlier work. And the video, which is very, very funny, it harkens back to the idea of being what we were talking about earlier with bands coming back. You know, you see Mac, who's the lead singer, touring as Superchunk, featuring one original member. And then the other three, you see how they've moved on to other things in their lives, and they see the flyers for Superchunk featuring one original member, and they get the band back together and wrest control away from their young hipster replacements. You know, like Laura tempts the bass player astray with a vinyl copy of Hall & Oates' Beauty on Backstreet. You know? And, you know, she just, like, puts down the bass, and, you know, she just shoves her out of the way and grabs the bass. And the drummer, the replacement drummer is wearing a green headband, and John Worster, the original drummer, garrots him with the headband while he's playing.
Nice.
It's really, really funny, and it's and I think the songwriting is really good. They just did a concert they did in D.C. Broadcast over NPR and downloadable as a podcast. So that kind of brought me up to speed on some of their earlier stuff, also. And I think they're I think they sound great, and I'm definitely looking forward to checking out the rest of their stuff.
That's interesting, because they're another band that definitely, with everything that's been said about their new record recently, like I also missed them during the time period, and I've been pretty curious to catch up. So that's a worthy endorsement to check out for sure.
That's going to do it for this episode of the Pop Does Podcast. I want to thank Matt Wardlaw and Michael Parr for joining us on the show today, guys. Thanks a lot.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And once again, we will say a giant fuck you to Jeff Giles and Jason Hare. But mostly to Jeff, because he was supposed to be here.
Yeah, Jason has a legitimate reason.
Yeah. We should also say that in addition to writing for Pop Does, Matt blogs at the great site addictedtovinyl.com, which is really a misnomer because Matt isn't addicted to vinyl. He's addicted to junk food.
Nice.
And the discussion doesn't end here. What are some of your favorite cases of subtraction by addition? Leave a comment in the show notes where you'll find links to everything that we've discussed today, as well as a link to the Facebook page for fans of the podcast. And if you're new to the show, you can find the previous 12 episodes at iTunes. And as I say every month, while you're there, please leave a review, because it helps give the show greater exposure. And you can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/popdos. And so that's it for this month. And hopefully we'll be back in October. The way things are going, it doesn't look like we can promise anything. But I know I'm going to try. I can't speak for the others.
Well, thanks again, Dave.
Thank you.
And we're sorry.
Anything else? Anything else that anybody has to add?
No.
No.
Good night, Greasy.
Yeah. Good night.
You know, I wish Jeff was here, because I'd be interested to hear his opinion on that. So. But since Jeff couldn't bother to keep his appointment with us, I guess we'll never know.
Yeah, fuck you, Jeff Giles. Fuck you. leave me here alone with these two assholes.